From Tidbits on September 27th, 2010, this is iTunes Bloated? By Kirk McElhern. There's a collocation that's becoming increasingly common, the proximity of the words iTunes and bloated. Google those words and you'll get about 220,000 results. As an author who specializes in explaining iTunes, I hear this often, yet many of the complaints I hear don't go further than hurling that invective at the program. Few people actually explain why they feel the program is bloated, and those who do have reasons that I tend to disagree with. So I thought I'd take a look at this question and the common answers in an attempt to determine once and for all whether iTunes deserves to be called bloated. First of all, how do you define bloated? Wikipedia offers the following in the introduction to its article about software bloat. Software bloat is a term used to describe the tendency of newer computer programs to have a larger installation footprint or have many unnecessary features that are not used by end users, or just generally use more system resources than necessary while offering little or no benefit to its users. With this in mind, I asked the question, do you think iTunes is bloated, on my website in June 2010, and I have also asked the same question on several forums I frequent. I've taken into account many of the answers I've seen, and the following is an attempt to address this question. How big is iTunes? While the Wikipedia definition of software bloat is partially valid, I think the first part of it to discount is that of a larger installation footprint. The iTunes 10.0 application on Mac OS X takes up 146.6 megabytes. In these days of terabyte hard disks, or disks offering several hundred gigabytes on older Macs, this is hardly a large application. Without looking at large-scale application suites such as Microsoft Office or Adobe Creative Suite, I have several applications on my Mac that are larger than iTunes. Adobe Reader takes up 219 megabytes, Bento is 188 megabytes, and two of the iWork programs, Pages and Keynote, each exceed 290 megabytes. Some people say that larger applications take more time to load, yet this is not necessarily the case. When you look under the hood of iTunes, you find some interesting numbers. The actual executable of the program and its libraries make about 33 megabytes, which is by no means huge. The majority of the iTunes application is, in fact, made up of language resources. These are files containing texts for menus, alerts, and even help, and in different languages that the program supports. If you are an English speaker and remove all the language resources you don't need, the program becomes a mere 65 megabytes. You can use the free utility iClean language to remove language files from iTunes and your other applications. Doing so could save you as much as a couple of gigabytes, depending on how many applications you have installed. Now I'm discussing the Mac version of iTunes here. On Windows, things are probably similar, but I haven't looked at the actual file sizes in Windows. Journalist Ed Bott seems to have made a career out of railing against iTunes in that world, and he updates his unofficial guide to installing iTunes without bloatware for every new version. While Bott's approach is a bit obsessive, it is true that Windows users do have to download some software elements that Mac users don't. Things such as QuickTime, Bonjour, and the software update are an integral part of Mac OS X, but need to be installed by the Windows version of iTunes for basic iTunes functionality to work. But worrying about a few dozen megabytes of software installed on a capacious modern hard disk seems like overkill. The only reason I could see to go to the trouble of following his advice is if you want to run iTunes on a netbook with limited disk space, and you want to save as much space as possible. RAM usage is a more complex issue. On Mac OS X, applications often ask for a lot of RAM, even if they don't use it, and the amount of RAM they request depends on how much memory the Mac has. If you have, say, 8 gigabytes of RAM, any program will ask for more RAM than on a Mac with 2 gigabytes. On my 4 gigabyte Mac Mini, the Finder is currently using 140 meg of RAM. On my 2 gigabyte MacBook Air, only 84 megabytes. iTunes on my Mac Mini regularly asks for 200 megabytes or more, which, out of 4 gigabytes, seems acceptable. When I launch the program on my MacBook Air with a much smaller library, it asks for only 63 megabytes. So what you see is not always what you get. You may see iTunes claiming it's using a lot of RAM, but once other applications need that RAM, iTunes will give some back. How fast is iTunes? The second factor to consider is speed. This can be seen in two ways, the time it takes to launch a program and the time it takes to perform common operations. On my Mac Mini, with a library of nearly 60,000 items, iTunes launches in 7 seconds. On my MacBook Air, with a much smaller library, it takes only 4 seconds. In my opinion, neither of these is problematic. I remember when I was using a certain word processor back in the late 1990s, and it took some 45 seconds for the program to open. People who cannot wait 7 seconds for a program to open may need to rethink their priorities. The speed of certain operations is a more important issue. With today's multi-core processors and copious RAM, software should be able to do things quickly. Not all tasks, of course, because some are very complex. But basic tasks should never take too long, though the definition of too long is subjective. I've seen people complaining about the speed of ripping CDs with iTunes, or about the time it takes to sync an iPod or iPhone. Alas, neither of these tasks fully depend on iTunes itself. While iTunes' performance when ripping CDs is perplexing, sometimes it goes very slowly, other times more quickly, for no apparent reason, the two main factors affecting CD ripping are the speed of your optical drive and the speed of your processors. Back when I owned a Mac Pro, I bought a CD-only drive that read disks at up to 52x because I could buy and rip a lot of CDs. This led to rips that were almost twice as fast with a Mac Pro's internal 24x CD DVD drive. With my current Mac, a Mac Mini, I bought an external CD drive for the same reason. Syncing iOS devices depends in part on how long it takes iTunes to scan your library. Bigger libraries naturally take longer, but file transfer is limited to the throughput offered by USB 2.0. The only way to make syncing more rapid would be to move to the soon-to-be-available USB 3.0 or a similar data transfer standard. Some people will find that iTunes lags a bit with large libraries. This was a notable problem back with iTunes 7, and one that I wrote about in my blog. But when iTunes 8 came out, Apple changed the way the iTunes library file is written, reducing it in size by about 75% and changing the way iTunes works with the library file. Operations that lagged back in 2007 and 2008 are snappier now, and I'm working with a slower Mac, though there are still some slowdowns with large libraries. There may be some operations that take longer than a user wants, but does one now expect everything to happen immediately? I find that changing tags for a lot of files takes some time, but that's because the files are being written to disk. Saving downloaded files produces a slight delay of a few seconds, but this is likely related to the size of my library and the speed of my Mac Mini's hard disk. But iTunes certainly seems bloated to me. One comment I have seen often is that iTunes is bloated because it does so much, that Apple should separate it into different applications. I would call this a subjective feeling of bloat, because all those features you don't use don't affect performance. The program runs only the code you need when you need it. However, this is a valid complaint. From being initially just a music player, iTunes has added the capability to manage and play videos, movies and TV shows, and podcasts. More recently, iTunes has also added apps and ebooks to its library. Many people suggest that the name itself should be changed, that iTunes has gone far beyond Tunes. Alas, that will never happen. iTunes is a brand, not just a program. Apple has developed the brand name over nearly 10 years, naming their media store the iTunes Store. At least Apple shortened it a bit from the iTunes Music Store and have consistently avoided the iTunes name while talking about the App Store and the iBook Store. For more about Apple's success in the branding arena, see our 2002 series, Branding Apple. But what about all these content types and features? And the iTunes Store itself? Surely the presence of the iTunes Store is part of the program's bloat, right? Actually, it isn't. The iTunes Store is simply a web browser in iTunes. Pages from the iTunes Store and the new Ping are merely HTML pages that are rendered in iTunes using the same WebKit framework in Mac OS X that also renders HTML in Safari, Mail, and many other applications. While iTunes Store pages may be slow to load at times, this is more because they are graphically complex and require a certain amount of time to be downloaded and rendered, just like any other web page. The thing is, many people want a program to do only what they need it to do. If you don't listen to podcasts or buy movies, you may think iTunes should handle only music. If the presence of these different libraries in the iTunes sidebar bothers you, you can hide them. Choose iTunes Preferences, and in the Show section of the General Preference pane, deselect the libraries you don't want to see. Want to get rid of the iTunes Store? In the Parental Preference pane, select Disable iTunes Store. You'll have a very minimal iTunes interface. Does the program now seem more svelte? That syncing feeling. Another common criticism of iTunes is that it syncs many different types of content to iOS devices. While it makes sense that iTunes would sync the music, videos, apps, and ebooks in its library, the program also manages photos, contacts, email accounts, and more. Some people suggest that the syncing part of iTunes should be a separate application, such as the existing iSync. Others say to sync even music, one should be able to mount the devices and just drag and drop files to them. To the former argument, I wonder why people want to have to use two applications to sync an iPod or iPhone. Even if the syncing application handled the transfer of media files, there would still be one program for managing those files, and another to sync them. Surely one integrated program is better than two that would frequently need to be used in quick succession. The drag-and-drop argument is commonly mentioned by those used to doing that type of syncing to MP3 players back in the day. I've always found this a confusing idea. Every time you change tags in a file or add new music to your library, you need to remember which files you've changed or added to be able to sync them. Why would one want to go to the bother of manually syncing files in the first place? I think one of the reasons the iPod was so successful early on is because iTunes handles all of this for users. When you buy music, rip CDs, or add other content to your music library, you don't need to manipulate the actual files. You don't need to know where they're stored, and you don't have to worry about moving them. iTunes takes care of all this for you. The file system becomes an abstraction, and in fact, disappears behind the iTunes database. Creeping featureitis. It's certainly true that iTunes is a complex program. I've been using iTunes since the very first version, and I've been writing about the program for many years, notably from Macworld, where I've written dozens of articles about how to get the most out of iTunes. To be fair, you could accuse me of having a vested interest in the complexity of iTunes. The program has a lot of features, and this feature list is often criticized. iTunes does a lot. It offers you unequaled features for organizing and managing media. Yet many people feel that it doesn't do enough, hence the success of the Doug's AppleScript for iTunes website, with its oodles of scripts to enhance the program's functionality. iTunes is one of those programs that offers a wide range of features according to how a user wants to interact with their content. For basic users, it may be enough to dump media files into their library and sync their iPods. Their libraries may be smaller than the capacity of their iOS devices, so they don't even have to worry about choosing what to sync. For others, though, the small but growing percentage of users with large libraries, I count myself in this group, the capability to create complex smart playlists based on tags gives great power in organizing content. The verdict is, I think it's fair to say this whole question is a bit moot. It's a geek debate. For most users, iTunes is simply a program they use to manage an average-sized media library and some apps. Those who are confronted with the more complex features have much larger libraries and have different ways of working with media files. I can understand that many people have a subjective feeling of bloat when looking at iTunes because of the many types of media it manages, but it seems no more bloated than, say, a word processor that contains finicky page layout features. There have been ups and downs over the years, as I mentioned earlier, but Apple has resolved most of those issues. And if you still have that nagging feeling of unnecessary features staring you in the face, I've explained above how to change the iTunes interface so you don't have to see the types of media you don't use. This alone can make the program seem more simple. Don't get me wrong. Although I think Apple has done an excellent job over the years of grafting new types of media and new features onto the program, it's by no means perfect. Valid criticisms can be leveled at specific features and interface elements. iOS app file sharing, I'm looking at you, along with the way iTunes 10 removed all color from the sidebar in favor of a drab, uniform gray. But in the end, I suspect that people accuse iTunes of being bloated because it has evolved from a simple music player into a complex media and device management program that meets the needs of hundreds of millions of users. To become more comfortable and fluid with iTunes, therefore, may require learning a bit more about how it works and mastering those features you use every day. Kirk McElhern is a senior contributor to Macworld, an occasional contributor to Tidbits, and writes about more than just Macs in his blog, Kirkville. Follow him on Twitter at @McElhern. Kirk's latest book is Take Control of iTunes 10, The Fack. This is Tidbits, sponsored in part this week by Smile, Useful Fruit Software, Econ Technologies, and the Data Rescue Center. To follow links, make comments, read related articles, and subscribe via email, RSS, Twitter, and Facebook, visit us at tidbits.com. I'm Adam Engst, and thanks for listening.